Next case on our calendar for today is A18-1941, David W. Inglesma et al. Versus Zipkin Ventures LLC and Wayne Belial. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Counsel, good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Counsel for appellant and respondent will each have 15 minutes for their arguments, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. If you can please state your, you can be seated, I'm sorry. you can please state your name for the record and the party you represent. And there's also a switch on the podium if you would like to raise it up at all or lower it. Counsel for appellant can proceed when you are ready.
Your Honors, before I proceed, I did write a letter to the court about a visual aid. I have copies of those pursuant to the rules if I might approach. Or
if you could give them to the marshal, that would, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Your Honors, Mr. Belial brings this appeal. My name's Rob Shanus. May it please the court. I represent Wayne Belial. He brings this appeal because the district court's decision subjected him to damages amount that vastly exceeds his liability under a personal guarantee of a commercial lease. The district court's decision should be reversed for three reasons. First, under the plain language of the lease, the landlord suffered no damages after it terminated the lease in July of 2015, yet the district court awarded the landlord damages up until March of 2016. Second, to the extent that the landlord suffered any damages, they were fully mitigated by the fact that as part of payment for rent, the landlord received over $300,000 worth of building improvements from its new tenant. Finally, there is a fact dispute that should have precluded summary judgment in the landlord's favor concerning the reasonableness of the landlord's duty to mitigate its damages. There is an approximately 4-month period of time where the landlord had a contractual right to receive rent, and it simply forfeited that right. That is patently unreasonable, and at the very least should have created a fact issue precluding summary judgment.
Well, could I ask you this? Do you concede that the guarantor here did owe some money?
No.
Oh, so you think, I mean, before we even consider mitigation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
would you concede that there was an absolute guarantee here?
Yes.
In other words, you don't have to... Once there's a default, the obligation
is triggered.
Arose.
Yes, without any conditions precedent. And that, you're right, Your Honor, that's a distinction between an absolute and a conditional guarantee. The district court made the erroneous legal conclusion that because the guarantee is absolute, my client is barred forever from arguing the correct damages figure.
Okay. And let's just put mitigation to the side for a moment.
Sure.
What, assuming there's no mitigation, mm-hmm. for the time that this commercial unit sat without rent, that would be something that you would concede, I assume, that your client would owe if we don't consider mitigation?
If there is no mitigation of damages, my client concedes for the purposes of this appeal that he would owe rent from February or March of 2015 till July 20th of 2015 when the lease was terminated. But he would not owe rent after July 20th for a couple reasons, mostly based on the lease. If you go back to common law, it's important to understand it as a starting point. If you terminate a lease, if a landlord elects to terminate a lease, they forfeit the right to rent after termination because a termination of the lease has the effect of terminating the entire agreement. There's no agreement anymore that requires the payment of rent. That's true unless the lease says otherwise. If you look at the Galbraith versus Wood decision or the Provident Mutual decision, both cited in our brief, they both stand for the proposition that you need what's sometimes referred to as an anti-forfeiture provision in order to have any right to rent after termination. This lease does have an anti-forfeiture provision, and we concede that. But what it says is that it also contains a measure of damages provision. It says that damages are to be calculated by the difference between the rent under the lease through the end of the term and the then reasonable rental value. Now, in May of 2015, the landlord signed a new lease with an entity called AMG. And under that lease, AMG agreed to pay more rent than under the original lease.
Right, but that didn't kick in until October of 2015.
That's when they started to pay full rent, but the landlord concedes that they terminated the lease on July 20th, 2015.
So it's your position that's when your client no longer had an obligation to pay any rent?
Right, because if there was no new lease at all, we would still have been entitled to argue that the rental value, the market value of the rental space was more. We don't have to make that argument based on expert testimony or anything of the like because we have actual evidence as of May 2015 when they signed the lease. That dictates the market value, and the landlord concedes that. They concede that the market value as of May 2015 was greater.
Why wouldn't you be liable at least through October when rent would be paid because the landlord up to that point had taken reasonable steps to mitigate their damages?
The reason we're not liable is because of what the lease says. The lease says that at the point of termination, you do this calculation.
What exact language in the lease are you referring to when you say the lease says that this is how you calculate it?
Sure. So if you look at the handout in front of you and you turn to the second page of the lease language, you have the very last paragraph of what is Article 18, Section 3. And this is the anti-forfeiture provision. This is the provision that provides the landlord with a right to collect rent after terminating the lease.
Okay, and what paragraph would that be?
It's the last paragraph of Section 3.
It starts with notwithstanding?
Notwithstanding any such reletting without termination, landlord may at any time thereafter elect to terminate the lease for trust previous breach. That goes on to say, it may recover from tenant all damages it may incur by reason of such breach, including the cost of recovering the lease premises, reasonable attorney's fees, and including the worth at the time of such termination of the excess, if any, of the amount of rent and charges equivalent to rent reserved in the existing lease, paraphrasing, for the remainder of the stated term over the then reasonable rental value of the lease premises. The then reasonable rental value answers your question, Judge Reyes. That's what we're looking at. At the time of termination, what is the reasonable rental value? It's irrelevant when they started actually paying rent. It's irrelevant under this provision whether rent was ever paid by any tenant. Our evidence was that the then reasonable rental value exceeded the rent paid under the lease. And it's unsurprising that the rent was worth more.
Well, I know you're focusing on that provision, but what about the other provision? And I don't know the number exactly, but it says upon termination of the lease, the liability of the tenant for the rent provided for herein above shall not be extinguished for the balance of the term remaining after said termination.
So let's look at that language. Because it doesn't say upon termination of the lease, it says upon termination of the estate, which is different than the lease. So if you start at the top of Article 18, Sections 1, 2, and the first paragraph of Section 3, all discuss termination of the tenant's estate. Starting with Section 1, landlord may terminate tenant's estate herein demised and tenant's right to possession. It then goes on in section 3, where you find the language quoted by respondent in their brief. Upon termination of the estate, as aforesaid, okay, we're still referring to termination of the tenant's estate. And then in the last sentence, notwithstanding such termination, the liability of tenant for the rent provided for here and above shall not be extinguished. This is saying that if you terminate the tenant's estate, you evict the tenant, you are still entitled to rent. But continue reading down, and it now, in the next paragraph, gives you the option to relet or terminate the lease. Should termination of tenant's estate as herein provided, or should landlord take possession pursuant to legal proceedings, etc., it may either terminate this lease, or it may from time to time, without terminating this lease, make such alterations as repairs as may be necessary in order to relet the premises and relet said premises. It is a common election of remedies in a commercial lease to have the option to terminate the lease or to relet the premises. And so now you look at what the damages calculations are in each circumstance.
Well, isn't it also common to not only terminate the lease, but also have a guarantor basically cover the time period where the unit sits empty and there's no income coming in because of that breach of that prior tenant?
I don't know whether that's common or uncommon. What I can tell you is that the lease, the guarantee at issue here says that we've guaranteed the obligations under the lease. So you have to look to the lease to determine what the obligations are in the event of a default. And the parties here agreed that the obligations are if reletting, so if the landlord had elected to relet and not terminate the lease, then you would be right. The obligation would be to pay rent as it becomes due over time until the end of the lease term. But this is a unique situation where the landlord elected to terminate. It's a rarely exercised remedy by a landlord. But they elected to terminate the lease. And that's undisputed. And upon terminating the lease tells you how to calculate damages. It also makes damages immediately due and payable, as opposed to waiting. The landlord doesn't have to wait. They can collect the damages right away, as measured according to the lease. Now, there are times when this calculation is going to work out really well for a landlord, where the difference between the, you know, if you were asking a landlord in 2008, the difference between rental value and a lease is probably hugely advantageous to the landlord because prices went down. But as it stands under this lease, it's disadvantageous, and the landlord doesn't want this provision applied. Now, they concede that this is the provision that applies unless there's another one, and that's true because under common law, as I said before, the lease needs to provide a right to rent after termination. If the lease doesn't provide it, it doesn't exist. And the provision they point to has to deal with termination of the estate. And it's, of course, true that a landlord evicts a tenant. You wouldn't, by evicting your tenant, give up your right to rent.
Counsel, what about respondent's argument that the damages were established through the default judgment, and so they're really not properly re-examined at this point, that as the guarantor, you're responsible for those damages?
Yeah, I mean, that argument is just wrong. It's wrong factually, and it's wrong legally. It's wrong legally because the default of a co-defendant, I believe the case is Wood, but it's cited in our brief, the default of a co-defendant doesn't extinguish their co-defendant's right to defend themselves. Mr. Belisle served and filed an answer timely. Their argument makes no sense, legally or factually.
Did Mr. Belisle participate in that proceeding other than to serve an answer?
Yeah, I was at that oral argument, and on the record, Mr. Klobuchar agreed that that proceeding would not have any adverse impact on my client. We didn't order the transcript for that, and we did file with this court a stipulation between us to the effect that I just described. And no one from this panel, but one of the judges, said we couldn't file that. And it wasn't, it simply wasn't worthwhile to get the transcript from that hearing because as a legal matter, it's not effective to damn someone to a damages figure against them when they're actively defending. There's a right to due process, and that right involves the submission of evidence and so forth. But the law is extremely clear on this point. The case law that we cited is very clear that you can't.
And just briefly, the mitigation of damages, what's your opinion as to whether your client has the right to raise that argument?
He does have the right to raise it because for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's not a defense to say your damages calculation is wrong. Okay, it's not. It often is confused. We're not defending on the basis of a failure to mitigate damages for the pre-termination rent.
But isn't a guarantee a different type of responsibility than that of the lessee? And isn't the defense of mitigation of damages a defense that belongs to the lessee?
No, because how under a guarantee do you figure out what my client owes? It doesn't say it. All it says is he owes whatever's owed under the lease. So you have to look to the lease to see what he owes. And if the lease has damages provisions, then those are what, you know, if the lease says this is what the damages are in the event of a default, that's the only place you have to look.
Under what authority does your right of mitigation arise?
It arises under common law. There's a common law duty to apply rent towards mitigation if you receive it.
All right. Is there anything in this lease that provides for mitigation?
Yes, there is. There's language in the lease, and I see that my time is up. If I might just answer this last question. There is language in the lease that addresses the duty to apply rent towards mitigation, and there's an extensive argument back and forth between the parties about how that provision works. But yes.
Okay. Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Jeffrey Klobuchar, may it please the court, on behalf of the landlord in this case, who is obviously the respondent. This court should affirm the grant of summary judgment below here today for three reasons. First of all, the absolute and unconditional nature of that guarantee, when coupled with the default judgment, establishes the liability, as Judge Cochran was just discussing. Second, the landlord is entitled to the full measure of the benefit of the bargain damages as a result of the breach of contract, and the language of the lease, in fact, does not forbid that. Third, the appellant did not set forth sufficient evidence to create an issue of material fact with respect to the mitigation issue and failed to carry his burden, and as a result, summary judgment was appropriate.
I want to go to the first one, if I may, in terms of absolute and unconditional guarantee. Doesn't that really go to when the debt accrues?
In this case, it doesn't, Your Honor. Typically, it would because the establishment...
Typically, it does, though, right? Typically, that language, whether it's absolute or conditional guarantee, goes to the issue of when the clock starts ticking, when your client can receive the monies, correct?
Yes, an absolute guarantee means that there are no further conditions. Once a debt is established, my client can enforce that guarantee.
Right.
Is that, so, if that's the understanding?
Yeah, question, yeah. Yes. So, and that's how I read the case law on that point. But it seems like you're trying to argue that that actually creates, the flip side of that is you're reading that to be an explicit waiver of any defenses, including defense of mitigation.
I think in the context of a default judgment in a guarantee situation, it changes markedly because what's happened...
The default judgment is just against the other party. It's not against this party.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the default judgment has now established concretely what the liability underlying the contract was. Remember that the guarantee is a guarantee, and the language in the guarantee is any and all amounts due by the tenant.
But that's assuming that issue had been litigated with respect to this particular co-defendant, and that has not occurred yet. So that damages is not, that damages number is not set in stone. Furthermore, if there are defenses to it, it seems that those would still be available, assuming that those conditions are actually met to actually meet those defenses.
I think, in fact, Your Honor, that's not what the state of the law is. All of the cases cited by the appellant on that issue involve negligence cases, tort cases, and other issues where you're actually a true co-defendant, where you stand in the same exact shoes, meaning that you're both liable for that same conduct. The guarantee context changes that rationale because you are, under the Lundgren case, a secondary obligor to the debt owed by the primary obligor.
What about appellant's point that he would be deprived of due process if he's not allowed to litigate that issue?
Well, there's two points I think that need to be raised here. First of all, counsel indicated that there was a stipulation on the record at that first hearing, and it's true that there was. But it wasn't that it wouldn't have any adverse effect on his client. The stipulation was that any rights that he had at that time would be preserved. There's a vast difference between those two things. We weren't seeking any remedy affirmatively as against his client because we hadn't moved for default judgment with respect to the guarantee. If there were defenses, he would have the right to raise them.
Right.
We argue that there are not.
That seems to be the position I was trying to argue earlier, though, or make earlier. It seems like you've confirmed the point I was trying to make earlier then.
Perhaps I have. If there were any defenses that were available to the guarantor, he would be able to raise them.
Okay.
However, the calculation of damages likely isn't won because that has now been established by court order. A judgment by default is still on the merits, especially in a context like this, where the appellant was given notice of the motion for default judgment, certainly could have interposed a response to the motion and did not.
Well, you argue in your brief that he should have intervened, but how can you intervene when you're already a party to it?
I think intervention is kind of an inartful way for us to have described the process that should have occurred. I agree with counsel that intervention is really typically used in a third-party context where someone's coming in to protect rights that they otherwise weren't able to protect. And Mr. Belisle would have been able to protect his rights in this case had he taken another step, which is to respond to the motion for default judgment. He elected not to. There certainly was a stipulation on the record out of an abundance of caution to say that any rights you had are preserved. We're not seeking a remedy against you, but in the default judgment combined guarantee context, it just changes the calculation.
I want to go back to the defense of mitigation. What language in the lease agreement can you point to that is an explicit waiver of that defense?
I cannot point to any language that is an explicit waiver of that defense, Your Honor.
You.
If I might, I'd like to move now to the second issue the court spent a lot of time with on the with opposing counsel, which is this full measure of damage with respect to this provision in the lease that was read to you. I would note, importantly, that one provision that was not read to you, that was skipped over, is should the landlord at any time terminate this lease for breach, in addition to any other remedies it may have, it may recover from tenant all damages it may incur.
And what section are you reading from? Currently?
Same section that my opposing counsel read from that starts with notwithstanding, the final paragraph in Article 18. Notwithstanding any such reletting without termination. So this is important.
So the second sentence of that paragraph.
Correct. It says, landlord may at any time thereafter elect to terminate the lease for such previous breach. Should they do so, in addition to any other remedies they may have, it can recover from tenant all such damages, including, notice that it doesn't say including and limited to. It says including. There's no limitation here. Importantly, this is not a limitation or a measure of damages provision as provided for by the appellant. Instead, this is an acceleration clause. This permits the landlord, in the event described earlier, where rent is moving down in value over the remaining time on a lease, post-termination, the landlord can right now take the delta between what the rent is and what the rent is that it can get, accelerate that amount, and recover it right now. That's all this is.
Right,
this is not a limitation.
But doesn't your right to be able to recover on rent expire upon termination of the lease?
No, it doesn't.
Why
Your
not?
Honor. Because all of the cases that follow, the Galbraith case, Grumman, Kalkoff, the other cases indicate that once you've terminated, you're now entitled to your breach of contract damages, meaning the damages that put you in the same position you would have been in had the tenant not breached. Whether or not you consider that rent or contract damages matters in terms of legal esoterics, because it's not that you're unable to collect any further damages, it's just that you're not able to characterize those damages really as rent. You're entitled to the benefit of your bargain still.
What was the term of this lease?
This lease, I believe, was a five... It expired in March of 2016, if my recollection serves me. That was the final month on that term.
So the measure of damages that your client was awarded went through the term of the lease?
It did. Less what it actually received from the new tenant. It received certain rental amounts, including, I believe it was the additional rent for January and February of 2016, and then the base rent and additional rent for March of 2016. Those amounts, it offset. It does not seek remuneration for those amounts here because they were appropriately mitigated.
Okay, so just to be clear, because we're going back and forth in terms of timeline, so your argument is that your damages were mitigated basically from January till the end of the contract of March?
Partially through January and February and then fully in March. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so you're not seeking those damages at all?
Correct.
For that time period. But you're seeking damages from the time, from what time specifically are you seeking damages from till basically through January?
Yep. So from the time of the breach in February of 2015, we seek damages, and you can call them post-default pre-termination damages from February 2015 through July 20th of 2015, and then post-termination breach of contract damages from July 20th, 2015, through the end of the lease term, less mitigated damages that we received from the new tenant.
Okay, so, and I certainly can ask the opposing counsel this, my understanding, there's no dispute that they do, in fact, owe money from February to July at a minimum. I think they would.
I don't know that opposing counsel would agree with that, but
well,
I think that's a fair statement, yes. Okay. And let me tell you why that's true. Number one.
If that's conceded, then I don't think we need to get into the details of that. But what I want to focus on more is on the mitigation aspect of it. Because if you have a new tenant in place, you've got a new agreement, new tenant in place, and you set the rent to begin, I believe it was in October, is when rent would begin. But not once, but twice, you forgave the rent obligation. But there was a rent obligation in place. And the case law is pretty clear in terms of mitigation and damages. It has to be reasonable. How is that reasonable? And doesn't that create a fact issue?
I don't think it does create a fact issue, Your Honor. It's reasonable in the industry for landlords, especially. So let me bring you back a little bit through the facts and the record here. My client attempted to get this particular property rented to a number of different entities, Green Mill, others, and they had trouble.
Sorry to interrupt. Just to put this in context as well, we have to look at the facts in light most favorable to the non-moving party. So we have to look at and assume that their allegations are true, okay, in terms of whether or not there's a material issue of fact. So
fair
with that,
enough.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, I'd like to point out that in that respect, there are no facts. The appellant has cited no facts that make this unreasonable. They've only cited legal precedent to say that it is unreasonable for us to have done this. There's no factual allegation that anything we did was unreasonable. The only facts on that point are that they told us that they needed help with construction costs, that they needed time to get the construction finished so that they could open, they could get the permits, they could move forward and operate as a restaurant. So there's no facts that rebut that are in the record to my knowledge. And perhaps opposing counsel will disagree with that. But to my knowledge, the answer to your question is that there was no fact issue presented, which is why the district court found that facts had not been presented to create an issue of fact for trial on that point.
Well, but doesn't it create a fact issue by, well, first of all, it sounds like a fact issue in the first instance, but second of all, isn't there an issue of material fact when you look at the extension of, or the forgiveness of rent, not once, but twice, in terms of, okay, why is that being done? And that seems unreasonable to do that. Doesn't that raise an issue of whether or not that was reasonable or not? I'm not saying it was or not, but it seems to be something that the district court would need to consider that the district court in this case did not.
I would agree with you that it doesn't appear that the district court considered that. I don't think it was necessary for them to consider it because there were no facts presented that would rebut the facts that we set forth.
Well, the district court didn't even say that. That wasn't even part of the district court's order.
I don't disagree with the court in that respect.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
I think, so, and I want to get back to this point before about this acceleration clause and why there's no limitation on damages here. I just want to make sure I've made that clear. The fact that there's no limitation on damages then means that we're entitled to the full measure of our damages, less anything that we've mitigated. I also
so want... So you're agreeing that the guarantor here was entitled to mitigation of damages and the calculation of whatever damages were owed. It's just we're disagreeing on what the nature of that mitigation. Am I correct?
I don't know that I would agree that the guarantor was entitled to the defense of mitigation. There's a couple of issues here. Number one, the reasonability question to me seems like an argument saying that we failed to mitigate appropriately, which is an affirmative defense not raised in the answer. And Judge Sullivan kind of skirted around that issue a little bit, but found ultimately that that defense was not available because it had to have been raised, is my recollection of the record. But with respect to the other side of this argument that counsel has made with respect to the $300,000 in repairs, and whether that serves to mitigate our damages, the breach of contract damages that we discussed, there's simply no evidence that we received any of those damages. A commercial landlord receives rent. It doesn't receive repairs. It doesn't receive those other payment intangibles or other sorts of things as a result of this. There's no quantification. There was no expert testimony in the record to indicate what that value was. There's simply one line, effectively, of deposition testimony to discuss
counsel,
that
counsel, for
fact.
Those repairs under the original lease, whose duty was it to make those repairs? Was it the lessees or the lessors?
It was the landlord's duty to make the repairs, some of the repairs. Any of the repairs to the exterior of the building and foundation under the terms of this lease were the duty of the landlord. And I would agree with counsel that the amendment, the Sixth Amendment to the lease, did not change that. I think, frankly, the district court got that wrong. I don't think there was any sort of modification upon further review of the pleadings in that respect. But...
So your client did get a benefit from that?
No, they didn't. In the commercial landlord context, they don't receive any financial benefit from repairs that are done really for the benefit of the tenant. The tenant doesn't perform those repairs, it can't get its permits, it can't operate. If you look at what happens with respect to breach of contract damages, I see I'm running out of time.
Your time is, you can answer.
With respect to breach of contract damages, you're entitled to be put in the place that you would have been had the tenant fully performed. In this case, had the tenant fully performed, we would have obtained another $257,000 in change in rent. And at the end of it, we would have had a property. Now, if that property was in disrepair, that's our problem. But it doesn't stand to reason simply that because we had an obligation under the contract to do repairs that they'd ever invoked that provision or that we would have had to take additional steps. We own the property. We can do what we want. So that's not a fair offset in this case. For that reason, there just isn't any evidence with respect to mitigation, and we'd ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, you may get the impression by now that there's a lot to be desired with the district court's order and decision. Starting from the top of the list is this issue of, that most of the decision was based on this issue that the guarantee was absolute. That's plainly not a basis under the law for denying someone the right to argue about mitigation. In fact, the landlord didn't even address the issue in their brief. They didn't try and argue to this court that that part of the district court's decision should be upheld. There's no argument to be made. Judge Reyes, you asked about a concession, and I want to clarify our position on that. We do not concede that we owe any rent, and the reason is that for the post-termination, an overarching argument is that the damages have been fully mitigated, regardless of whether you rely on the lease or not, and that's true because the damages are about $257,000, and the landlord received $300,000 of these improvements during...
Fair enough, and I want to get to that, and then I want to go back to the point that you're raising. The $300,000 is for repairs. It's not for rent. Why would that be part of the mitigation calculation?
Well, let's imagine for a minute that you decide that. that you decide that it's not rent and it doesn't count. Every landlord, money is fungible. You can switch your requirements of a tenant to pay rent to you, or you can ask them to pay for improvements that you're obligated to pay. If you come to my house and I say, well, you owe me $300, but instead of paying me $300, I've got this roof repair, just pay the roofer.
But we're talking about mitigation of damages. And so how is...
So rent can be paid in many forms. It can be paid in cash, or it can be paid in kind, or it can be paid in agriculture, as one of the cases we cite.
So in other words, what you're trying to argue is the rent, in essence, was paid in kind by them paying the repairs?
Yeah, this is no less a rent payment than their monthly rent payment is.
It's okay. Is there anything in the record to indicate that's what it's being done for?
Yes, the testimony in the record from the landlord's agent was that money is over and above the market rent.
And above, right.
But it's still a payment that is consideration for the right to rent the space.
But that's addressed separately in the agreement between them in terms of the rent payments.
Right, but the case law we do cite shows that the duty to mitigate extends beyond the payment of rent to any revenue that's received by the landlord.
The new tenant wasn't occupying the building at the time these repairs were made, correct?
That's right, but all the repairs were paid for during our lease term. So the $300,000 was paid for by March of 2016, by the end of our lease term. So the comparison, Judge Cochran, that you were making is an apt one, in that under the original lease, the landlord was obligated to make all these, to pay for these improvements that they valued themselves at over $300,000. They're obligated to do it during our lease term. Instead, during our lease term, the new tenant paid for it.
Okay, so let's assume for the sake of argument that we don't buy your argument of the $300,000.
Okay.
Because I just want to focus, I want to go back to the timeline, okay?
Sure.
And so let's put aside the $300,000. If we're just looking at the actual rent payments themselves.
Sure.
Would you agree then that that your client would be responsible for the breach from February to July 20th at a minimum then?
Yes.
Okay. And then your argument is from July to roughly January, those should have been mitigated because you had somebody...
To March. In those 2 months, January and February, their tenant paid for like the costs associated with the building, but not the rent, but yes.
Right, I realize it's a little squishy in the last months, but why do you say July and why not October? Because their agreement said your payments are supposed to start in October. Why isn't that the start? Because up to that point, they took reasonable efforts. It seems like they took reasonable efforts to try to get a new tenant in. Granted, it was, you know, right.
Because that's the date of termination. July 20th, 2015 is the conceded date when they terminated the lease.
Okay.
It's the date when the tenant occupied the building also. And so we had argued at summary judgment stage that they terminated the lease even earlier by virtue of signing a new lease. But really what the case law clearly supports is that termination occurs when a new tenant moves in. And rather than have that become a fact issue on summary judgment, which would have precluded summary judgment for the landlord instead elected to concede that the termination occurred on January 20th, 2015. And by making that concession...
July,
I'm sorry. I see that my time is up. If I might briefly conclude, for the three reasons that I mentioned before, we believe that this case really ought to be reversed. There is a fact dispute on the mitigation post-termination at the very least, and we believe that the lease here is clear that this landlord is not entitled to post-termination damages. These issues could have been better resolved by the trial court with a more full hearing, but the trial court stopped after deciding that because it's an absolute guarantee, we weren't entitled to argue this and didn't get to many of these issues. So I thank you.
Sure. Judge Hood,
I want to go back to the notwithstanding such reletting provision, because counsel for the respondent is indicating that the next sentence of that provision allows even post-termination for damages against the tenant and therefore against the guarantor. I mean, what argument do you have that this doesn't apply as it's written?
Sure. So there's both an argument based on the structure of law and an argument based on the lease. If you start from a premise that the common law says you need an anti-fort, you only get what's given in the lease in terms of post-termination damages, then the provision I pointed to is the only provision in the lease. And what they're pointing to is it's saying the language is in addition to other remedies. If I say to you, just linguistically, in addition to other fruit, you can have strawberries and blueberries. We should agree that what I'm referring to is you can have other fruit besides strawberries and blueberries. Here, it's saying in addition to other remedies, you can have these damages, this measure of damages. Their argument is essentially that somehow the reference to other remedies is also allowing them to pick from some other bucket of measure of damages. And that's not linguistically correct. It's by referring to other remedies, it's referring to other remedies besides those enumerated here.
So you disagree that this is an acceleration clause? You're saying
no, it is. It's an acceleration clause, sure. But that doesn't take away from any of the arguments that I've made about it. It happens to say that you can have this measure of damages and you can have it now upon termination.
It includes an election of remedies, essentially.
No, it does not include election of remedies. That's exactly what I'm not saying. I'm saying that...
Well, I guess I'm confused then. I thought you were saying that if they choose this remedy, that's their remedy and they can't... They don't have other remedies available.
That's their damages calculation.
That's their damages calculation.
They have remedies available other than damages. For instance, the right to evict the tenant is a chief remedy that you would not want to give.
So this is just a reference to other claims or causes of action they might have, like eviction or something along those lines, versus a specific right to seek post-termination damages?
That's right. And I believe the landlord essentially conceded that because they took the path I would expect them to take, which is to say, this says I can have other remedies. I recognize that the common law says that these remedies need to be found in the lease. I'm going to find another lease provision. And so their argument in the brief is, here's another lease provision that gives us that right. Well, it turned out that it didn't. It didn't give them the right. It just applied to termination of the estate, not the lease. So they do have other remedies available, and they would have to tell you what the sources of those remedies were, but not other measures of damages in the event of termination. This is the only one in the lease.
But why can't you have, I mean, under this lease, not only the right to evict, but the right to collect damages from the tenant you evicted?
You do. You have three different rights. In fact, you have the right to evict, and after you evict, you have the right to choose whether you're going to relet or terminate. And if you relet, you get all of your damages, but you can't collect them immediately. You have to wait till they become due, okay? And that's because maybe you get a new tenant and so forth. If you elect to terminate, you have the right to the damages under this termination provision, which is the difference in value between the present rent and the market rent at this time and at this moment of termination. So you do. You have the right, and then it's the landlord's election to terminate.
Well, actually, it doesn't say as an election of other remedies. It says in addition to any other remedies it may have.
Well, if you
look... It sounds like this is an additional remedy.
So it does say, under Section 3, second paragraph down, should termination of tenant's estate is herein provided or should landlord take possession pursuant to legal proceedings, it may either terminate this lease... Or it may, from time to time, relet. There's your election. Then it goes on to explain what the measure of damages are, depending on what the election is.
But I'm referring to the clause, should landlord at any time terminate this lease for any breach, in addition to any other remedies it may have, it may recover from tenant all damages it may incur.
Right, and my position is that reference to any other remedies it may have is necessarily not referring to other measures of damages. It doesn't give them the right to elect a different measure of damages. It gives them the right to pursue any other remedies that they may have besides those expressly enumerated. If we read it the way you're describing, Judge Hooten, where it would allow them to pick other measures of damages, then the provision would be eviscerated. There would be no point in writing down a very specific method for measuring damages in the event of termination if the landlord could simply elect anyone that their heart desired at the time. Well, what's better for me today? How's the market? You know, these are not considerations that a landlord can make. They have to follow the lease.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Yeah, thank you.
The matter was very well argued by both parties. We will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory time frame. The next item on our calendar is scheduled for 11:30. I think we will take a quick 5-minute recess and come back because council is just arriving.
All rise.
I'll roll over you.